The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Over the past four decades, veteran reporter Robert Scheer has built a reputation as one of the leading journalists in this country. He has interviewed Presidents Nixon, Carter, Reagan, and Clinton, and he is the author of seven books. His latest, which he will discuss tonight, is The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. At a time when it has become commonplace to exploit fears of terrorist attacks, and few national leaders are willing to advocate cuts in defense spending, nuclear disarmament, and restrained use of American force, Scheer's book is a manifesto for enlightened reform. One of his current blogs is titled, "Where is the Outrage?" And that could also be Robert Scheer's signature question. Between 1964 and 69, Robert Scheer was Vietnam correspondent, managing editor, and editor-in-chief of Ramparts magazine. From 1976 to 93, he served as a national correspondent for the LA Times. In 93, he launched a nationally syndicated column based at the LA Times, and oh, how we miss him there. That column ran weekly. Yes, we do. And soon we may be missing the LA Times, so let's all be paying attention to that. It's really a real crisis going on there. That column ran weekly for the next 12 years and is now based at the San Francisco Chronicle. Robert Scheer is a contributing editor to The Nation as well as a Nation Fellow, and he's now the editor of the influential political blog TruthDig.com, and he can be heard on the political radio program Left, Right, and Center on KCRW 89.7 FM, which is tonight's media sponsor, and we thank KCRW as well for highlighting this event. In conversation with Bob tonight is John Dean, who was legal counsel to U.S. President Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal. I was telling one of our event attendants tonight, who was too young to know, of the early 70s. Dean's testimony before Senate investigators convinced many Americans that Nixon was closely involved in the criminal activities that eventually led to his resignation from the presidency. Dean went on to write books about his experiences in the Nixon White House, including Blind Ambition, which became a made-for-TV movie. And since then, he's worked as an investment banker in California and written columns, essays, and books. He is a prolific author on subjects as varied as President William G. Harding and Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist. His most recent book, Pure Goldwater, was written with former Senator Barry Goldwater's son. In 2004, he emerged as an outspoken critic of the administration of George W. Bush with his Bush book, that's a good one, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Okay, I've got all the B's confused there. Please, without further ado, please welcome Robert Scheer and John W. Dean to the Los Angeles Public Library.
I am the interlocutor tonight, Bob, which is the reverse of some the usual situation when I go to visit Bob's class over at USC, and he poses the questions and drives the conversation. But before I was coming down here tonight, I happened to stop at my mailbox at the bottom of the driveway, and my neighbor was there, Jill, and she had her daughter, Molly. And she says, "Where are you off to?" Wearing a coat and tie. So, "Well, I'm going down to the Central Library. I have a little recital," I said facetiously, "with a well-known L.A. Times reporter." And Molly, the little girl, looked up to me and said, "Well, Mr. Dean, what are you going to sing?" And I said to Jill, "Tell Molly, when she's a little older, that I only sing in front of Senate committees." I've talked to Bob about the new book, which I enjoyed greatly, and that's going to be the focus of our conversation tonight. But in reading it, one of the things that struck me was how it fits with my next-to-last book, Broken Government, where I talk and address all the processes of government, starting with the legislative branch, the first branch, the executive branch, and then the judicial branch. And what Bob has done in this book is really taken all those malfunctioning processes, and I did happen to focus on the way my former tribe, I'm now a registered independent, had governed for the last 40 years, and with some disquiet reported that they hadn't governed well. This is a wonderful case study of exactly the sort of things that go wrong when the processes of government are not being functioning properly, the people who are operating them are manipulating them, and it's only for all of our detriment. Bob, what I think what I'd really like to start with, because you know my feelings on it, is where did you get the title, The Pornography of Power?
You know, let me tell you, I'm really intimidated now. First of all, not only do I have enormous respect for John Dean, I actually think he's one of the great heroes of our modern history. And a point I make in my class is, had Richard Nixon not had a taping system in the White House, John Dean would be considered a bum. And yet people would say, sure, you told the president there's a cancer on the presidency. Sure, you told him. And the fact is, we had the tapes, which you can listen to now on the internet, and there was John Dean telling Nixon the truth. And, you know, he did this when he was just turned 31. He was a counsel when he was, so I guess you heard the introduction before. I'm always amazed. He must have been the smartest guy in the whole country to be a chief counsel at the age of 28, 29.
Trying to soften me up, are you, Bob?
No, not at all. I'm going to tell you how devastating it was when I talked to you the other day. And he doesn't suffer fools, okay? And so anytime I've made a mistake, he's been quick to point it out. And he also reads. Most people don't read. They buy books, some of them, hopefully, but they don't tend to read them. He seems to read three or four a day. I don't know how he does it. But anyway, I spoke to him on the phone the other day, and he said, terrible title. And I thought, holy, this is where it comes, you know. Now, you know, what's the bad news? And he said, I hate the title. Like the book, or did you say love the book? Love the book. My goodness, there's my blurb. We can go home, you know. But anyway, I was much relieved. And then he promised he would send me an errata sheet with all the errors that I had made, keeping true to form. So let me defend my terrible title. I could read from the back of the book where I tried to explain it, but
that doesn't explain it, Bob. All you say on the back of the book and in the book is that you suggest. This is the interpretation. So let's go one.
Okay, let me explain.
Effort deeper.
Let me explain why the title. First of all, I recycled the title from a previous book that I had, which was called "Thinking Tuna Fish, Talking Death," and essays on the pornography of power. And that's a book that I think sold three copies. I'm not sure. And everybody told me it was a terrible title, but I knew what I meant by it. I was covering nuclear weapons issues for the LA Times at the time, and I attended a conference at the Livermore Weapons Lab. I think it was a three-day conference, and the conference took place. We had to get past the barbed wire and the security and everything else. And with this conference, and I remember Herman Kahn gave a speech in which he suggested that, yes, there would be 80 million who would die in nuclear war fighting, but so what? Life would go on. And we were having lively discussions about first strike, second strike, what the weapons do, and so forth. And I was, getting a stomach ache from this discussion. I was getting enormously depressed. And I noticed that when we broke, none of my colleagues seemed to be the least bit upset. What they were upset was, were they in the VIP group that got invited to the special lunch where you had steak and lobster, or were they going to be with the slobs who had the buffet where we had the tuna fish? So that was the thinking death, talking death, thinking tuna fish. And what I have in mind with this use of the word pornography is, I think there's a big secret that the pundits and the politicians keep, which is that adults are watching the store. And maybe you have to be from the Bronx to understand what adults watching the store is. But you don't let a kid watch the candy store. They'll give away to all the candy. They're not serious and so forth. And we have an assumption, the people who cover politics, the people who do politics, that the thing being discussed is the important thing. Welfare, subprime mortgage, war and peace, and so forth. My experience as a journalist is that's not the case. That careerism is dominant, lining your pocket, looking out, feathering your own nest, worrying about your ambition, your ego, and so forth. And that, in fact, and that's what I try to get across with the description of Livermore, they really were not thinking through the consequence of those weapons and what they do and what's at stake. And I think that's true when we discussed welfare reform. I found that to be the case. We're not really talking about ending the only federal poverty program, and 70% of the people on that poverty program were children. You know, we talked about triangulation, we talked about the impact on the election, and so forth. And so when I came to this subject, it hit me that something very big has happened since... can I go on a little bit? It's okay.
Please,
okay.
All right. Please.
Since 9/11, and I dedicate the book to Dwight Eisenhower and George McGovern, two war heroes. People forget that when Nixon ran against McGovern, it was one of the finest moments I experienced, actually, later. But when he ran against McGovern, McGovern was described as this hopeless peacenik, right? A man who would not like to fight, would not protect his country. And Nixon, who had actually not seen combat, was the big warrior. And McGovern had won the Distinguished Flying Cross, crash landing his plane to save his troops. He'd done 34, I think is the number, bombing missions over Germany, and sometimes the fatality rate was almost 50% on some of those missions. So George McGovern was a true war hero. And so on one occasion, not that long ago, I asked George McGovern, we were on a nation cruise, and I asked him, I said, how come when you were attacked by everybody as, you know, not being willing to defend your country, you didn't bring up your own war record? And George McGovern said something that was, I think was the finest statement I ever heard from a politician. He said, it would have been unseemly. And that's George McGovern. It would not be a way I would describe Richard.
He's not shared that with John McCain yet, has he?
So, at any rate, I dedicate the book to Eisenhower and to McGovern because I say these are two warriors that did prefer plowshares to swords, and they really believed in a peace dividend. And this idea that I've been interested in ever since I remember when he first said it, and let me come out of the closet here, I actually, as a kid, wore an Ike button. It's probably the bravest thing I ever did. I was in the Bronx. It was not a popular position. And I think I was persuaded by I.F. Stone. I've never really researched it. It was either Murray Kempton or I.F. Stone or one of the other journalists, columnists who influenced me, that we had a better chance of getting peace with a guy who was a general and a Republican rather than with a Democrat who had to prove that he was warlike and so forth. And I think it turned out to be true with Eisenhower. But when Eisenhower gave his farewell address, we all are familiar with it, warning about the military-industrial complex. If you go back and read it, and I have big chunks of it, obviously, in my book, the warning is very serious. It says, we've developed a permanent military economy that has nothing to do with the enemy. And when Eisenhower...
I just get you to... footnote one comment before you go on about the Eisenhower speech.
Yeah.
What brought you to happen to read that speech? What happened to turn you to focus on the military-industrial complex?
Well, because when he first gave the speech, because I thought...
No. Of recent.
Oh, recently. Right. Well, I'll tell you. When 9/11 happened... Okay. Let me back up a little bit for a second, okay. George, I had covered Gorbachev, I covered the whole, you know, thing with Rezhevik and Reagan and everything, and I wrote a lot about the end of the Cold War. And then in 1992, George Bush's father, the first President Bush, gave a speech, and he said, I've ordered my Secretary of Defense to cut the military budget by 30%. That the Soviet Union is finished, the reason for these weapons that will fight a sophisticated enemy no longer exist, and it's time that the long-suffering American people who paid taxes to support this weaponry were given a peace dividend and that this money be applied to needed domestic purposes. That was George Bush's father. And he was not a naive man. He had been the ambassador to China. He'd been head of the CIA, and he had defeated Saddam Hussein. So he knew there were problems out there in the world. But nonetheless, he gave this speech. And so I felt this great excitement that we're finally, you know, peace will break out. And we'll finally have a peace dividend. And we were kind of moving along in that direction. Bill Clinton was a little bit more timid. You know, as I said before, Democrats are worried about being baited as being too peaceful. But nonetheless, we were moving in that direction. And despite the work of the neocons, who were active at that time, but the neocons really were a response to your old boss, Richard Nixon, whom they felt was a traitor because he had had the opening to China. He had done detente with the Soviets. He had pursued arms control. And people like Richard Perle, who were working for Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing, Wolfstetter, who was around, that's how he was known at the time. And I think I interviewed Jackson. I traveled with him quite a bit. I did a piece for Esquire. He seemed to be quite proud of the designation. You know, Boeing was a big part of his district. There were jobs, you know, as well as campaign contributions. But nonetheless, the neocons really come out of that rebellion against Nixon, that Nixon had betrayed them. And so when Bush's father did this, they revved up, and that's where you get the Project for the New American Century and so forth. I'm going to get to your point. And so we were moving in that direction. 9/11 happened, great tragedy. We all witnessed it and so forth. Not the biggest tragedy any nation ever had. And when we talk about, you know, I remember people saying, well, now everything is different. Now we can't have civil liberties. Now, you know, torture. Now we do blah, blah, blah. You know, I said, well, wait a minute. What nation hasn't had a similar excuse? You know, I mean, after all, plenty of nations have been attacked, you know, and we've always said, no, restraint on government is makes you stronger, not weaker. But anyway, we had this hysteria after 9/11, and then almost unnoticed, the response to 9/11 was not to figure out why did the Saudis have 15 of their people get papers and come here, you know, what was bin Laden doing in Afghanistan with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, two guys that had been recruited by the CIA, you know, how did this all start, what was it all about, how can we defeat it, you know, why didn't our FBI talk to our CIA, you know, we could go through all sorts of discussions. Instead, very early on, almost before we could even figure out what happened, George W. Bush asked for $20 billion more for defense. You know, that was the knee-jerk response, you know, and the game was open, the spigots were open. And since 9/11, that's where the hijacking comes in, it became a great excuse for dusting off all of these systems that no longer had any purpose and justify this enormous military buildup to the point where right now we spend more than all of the other nations in the world combined on the military, all of them combined. We are spending more this year than we did in real dollars, adjusted for inflation, than any time since World War II, more than during the Vietnam War and the Korean War, to build weapon systems to defeat an enemy, systems that the enemy never built. Okay, and
Let me just ask something to give the audience and myself some underlying context. Do you consider yourself a pacifist?
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
There are good wars. There are necessary wars.
Yeah, I'm not a
pacifist. There are just wars.
I'm very suspicious of the use of military power. And, you know, as a journalist, I've been in plenty of war zones. I was, you know, in Vietnam, bouncing around. And most recently, I was actually with my son, Peter, who was the editor, managing editor of Truthdig. We were in Cambodia during the civil war there. When Pol Pot was still alive, and we were up at Siem Reap, and then I was in Egypt and Israel at the time of the Six-Day War. I've been in war zones. I've seen the impact of war. I've seen the effect of surgical strikes and bombing. I, you know, so I've seen it up close. I hate it. I fear it, you know, and yes, I'm on guard against it, but no, I'm not a philosophical
pacifist. Let me ask another question.
Pacifist. And by the way, my criticism here is there were good things to spend money on that would have made us stronger. I'm certainly not opposed to body armor. I wasn't opposed to, you know, having your Humvees fortified. I'm certainly not opposed to recruiting people who know Arabic and Farsi so we can know what these people are thinking. You know, I think there are many ways to spend money that to make us stronger, yeah.
To draw from another interview you did once, do you think that George Bush, after 9/11, lusted in his heart for weapons?
No.
Why did he want them then? I think
it's not just George Bush. I mean, you know, because you read my book, Chapter 2 begins with a speech by a guy who says, I don't have...
The Rumsfeld speech?
Yeah. Oh, you gave away my punchline.
Sorry.
You know, I dug up this speech that Rumsfeld had made in the Pentagon where he, you know, it becomes very dramatic. We are besieged by an enemy. I'm sorry, there's my son Josh who dug it up, and he was my researcher. I don't want to steal credit from him. But I remember when Josh handed me this thing, I said, oh my God, you know, this speech in which Rumsfeld said, our big enemy that spans continents and wastes money and so forth, you know, and that is the Pentagon.
Bob,
and
sell this book. This is one people need to read to believe.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so they said, you know, he said that we waste trillions of dollars. Our computer can't talk to each other. We don't know where anything is. We're weakening the country. This was Rumsfeld. This was a position that basically George W. Bush at that time endorsed. After all, he came in, he campaigned on not doing regime change, on trying to follow some of his father's more moderate policies. And what happened with 9/11, because the speech what Rumsfeld gave was given on 9/10. And the next day, everything changed. And hysteria descended, and the military hawks swooped down, and Rumsfeld changed his tune, Cheney changed his tune, and George W. Bush changed his tune. Now, we can get into all sorts of analysis of whether this was his chance to exceed his father or what have you, but suddenly they had a ticket to ride. They had a thing to do, and it captivated them, and the media gave him a blank check. Our most distinguished journals, the New York Times, leading the pack, seemed to justify all this, built up the hysteria about WMD and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so they were off. They were off to the races, and there's been no looking back.
Before we get too far
away. So in terms of lust, I think what he lusted, what he lusted for was to exceed his father's record. Here was a deeply insecure person who had no business running for president, really hadn't been properly elected, and suddenly finds himself, gee whiz, now what do I do? You know, and it wasn't going well before 9/11. It was becoming a big mess, and then suddenly there's a way out. Wow, I'm going to be a big hero, you know. And
He needed work.
Well, he also pointedly rejected the people like Colin Powell and others who had come over from his father's administration who knew something about the world and who were reasonable people. And he went with the people I would consider to be extremists and who had an idea that was directly opposite to the one that George W. got elected on. He got elected on a platform that rejecting empire. He had embraced his father's new world order, which is not a return to empire and militarism. It's an emphasis on trade, on diplomacy, on a multipolar world. That's what George, you have a battle going on between Bush 1 and Bush 2. And after 9/11, Bush 2 redefined himself as the very thing that his father had warned us against, and a return to a very old imperial model of securing resources with military power, and it doesn't pay. We know that today. Just go fill up your car with gas. And controlling the oil, you know, and conquering these countries is a loser. That's why the French, the Germans, the Spanish, and everyone else got out of this business of the old imperial model. And now the price of oil went up fivefold since Bush has been president. So physical control of these resources is not a winner. And here, this is something we can learn from the Chinese communists, who are now the best capitalists in the world. And they go out around making all these agreements. They don't control any oil. They have hardly any in their own country. And they're not facing a recession right now.
Good points. As an author, I know how we slip into our standard sound bites.
Yes.
I'm going to take you out of
All
a couple
right.
again. I'm going to take you back to your title again, The Pornography of Power.
Yeah.
Because I don't, you state in the book that like Potter Stewart stated, you know it when you see it. That isn't what he said.
Oh. I knew you would.
Detail.
Is this in the...
But anyway, I would like to have you read and explain to this group, because there are certainly... The title is loaded with sexual innuendo, as are some of your references, the gyrations of lobbyists who are lap
dancing. I'm going to read this to you, Joe.
So
would you like to read it?
No, I'd like you to read it, and maybe extrapolate as you read along.
It's interesting. You're probably picking on the one thing that is helping this book in its sales.
no doubt about that.
but I'm perfectly willing to toss it out and go back to selling 3 copies. Okay. Okay. This is right on the back, in case you pick it up in the store and you think there's a lot of dirty pictures. And by the way, I have some expertise.
That's because your publisher didn't understand the title.
I have a lot of expertise in this. I worked for Playboy for over 20 years. I know something about the field. And, okay, what is the
pornography? I'm shocked to hear that Playboy is pornographic.
Okay, what is the pornography of power? Quote, "What it suggests to me is a vicarious experience that masks the real deal, substituting lurid and excitable imagery for an activity that is all too mundane and predictable. As you read of the gyrations of lobbyists and politicians eliciting billions for one weapon system or another in the name of fighting one enemy or another, see if you don't come to view it as a lap dance designed to hide the fact that all you are getting out of it is the opportunity to fork over ever larger amounts of money. You might also wonder, how did I let myself get seduced into this grimy and dangerous place just to get fleeced? That is the basic question faced by our republic."
Would you take me... Good point. Would you take me to the material where I can read the lap dance?
My point, getting back to the adults watching...
I love to do this to him.
And it really is... It's a theme in the book that I don't want to drop, because it's a real trap... To assume, again, that when they're talking about we need the F-22 and so forth and so on, that they really mean it. Because I don't think anyone with a straight face can say, you need these weapons. You know, here's Lieberman. We need 2 subs a year, a $75 billion program, okay? Lieberman's not an idiot. He knows he wants these subs because they're built in Connecticut. All right? He knows you do not need submarines to defeat Al-Qaeda's Navy, which, you know, doesn't even have rowboats, you know. So, okay.
Can't even swim.
Yeah. So what am I supposed to do? Say, oh, I don't think we should have 2. I think we should have 1 or 3 or, you know. No, that's a trap. And what I'm trying to suggest with the title is I'm not going to play that game. And I'm saying I'm going to challenge the entire enterprise. And then Lieberman comes back and he says, because they can't with a straight face, you know, say you need all these things. And so, okay, if it's not going to work again on the terrorism argument, of which they keep advancing, you know, war on terrorism, then we play the China card. Okay? And he does that, you know, and they all do. Okay, China. China's building submarines, blah, 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 you know? Okay. Well, the Russian and Chinese submarines are not allowed to leave port very often because they leak so badly. The Russian ones actually rust. But if you look at, again, if you're an adult and you look at the data, Congress has mandated the Defense Department to assess these threats. In 207, the most recent report we have, the Defense Department says China will require till the end of the decade or longer to become a mid-level regional power, not a global power, okay? And it says the focus of China's development is Taiwan. That's what it says, okay? And not conquering the United States or engaging our Navy or anything else. And what has happened in the last 2 weeks? You wouldn't know it from reading most of the newspapers, certainly not from watching cable news, right? But it seems that there's a love fest between Taiwan and the mainland. I don't know if anyone's noticed it, but you know, the Kuomintang Party, which after all only got to Taiwan when Chiang Kai-shek was defeated, right? Their leader of the Kuomintang Party went to the mainland. The new leader of Taiwan, who was in their party, was elected on a platform of closer relations with the mainland. And in fact, even his competitor favored warmer relations. And what have they been doing for the last 2 weeks? They've been talking about direct traffic, air transport between the two. They've been talking about vastly increasing tourism. And Taiwan, as we know, is one of the major investors in the mainland. They're not about to have a war there, okay? So that argument, the Chinese are coming, makes less sense than it ever did and never made much sense. So again, they invoke these arguments. Take the F-22, which I mentioned before. And I'm not going to deny these things are wonderful toys. You know, I studied engineering for years. You know, I can marvel at the technology. I'm sure the F-22, I've had an argument. Let me just take a little digression because I want to indicate this is a bipartisan problem. I was at a dinner party with Senator Boxer. I'm allowed to talk about this dinner party because I said something at the dinner party and Richard Reeves, who was our host, wrote a column about it. So I called him up and I said, was that party on the record? He said, of course, everything's on the record. I said, great. So I can now tell you the story. I was sitting at a table with Barbara Boxer and McCain's name came up, and I'm sure John is going to blast me. He blasts me for being soft on Nixon, and now I'm soft on McCain. And so somebody said something about McCain, and Bob's got a new book. And I said, well, actually, in my book, McCain looks pretty good. I know, I just lost the whole audience. But I'm sorry, that's where the facts went with a particular weapon system. And I said, and Barbara Boxer said, well,
we're going to follow up on
yes,
that.
Yes, I know. And so Barbara Boxer said something about, and I said, but Barbara, you know, and I had obviously tried to get interviews, so I said, you know, you don't look so good in my book. In fact, I got a whole chapter on you and that C-17 cargo plane they build down in Long Beach, you know, and that's a plane the Air Force didn't want, the Pentagon doesn't want, and you want to build it, you know, and you and Schwarzenegger and far right-wing congressmen and left-wing, why? Because the labor unions want it, there's jobs, campaign contributors, and so forth, you know, and it's a plane we don't need. And Barbara Boxer said, have you been in the 17? I said, no, I haven't been in. She said, well, it's a marvelous plane. Well, I'm sure it's a marvelous plane. What are you going to do with it? Well, you know, in Iraq, you know, which is a war she didn't even support, we need this plane. No, you don't. 90% of the material that goes in by Navy, which is a small fraction of the cost by shipping, and you should probably be sending even more. And the rest can go in, as it does quite often, by UPS and FedEx and planes like that. And besides, you do have cargo planes. You don't need this plane, okay? But it's a jobs program. It's a campaign contribution source and so forth. So yes, it goes across the board. I forgot where I was going at the beginning, but I know I'm making a lot of sense.
No,
I was going to say, about the F-22, let me just throw that one in, and then I won't give any more speeches, but I'm very revved on that one. Okay, the F-22, again, it's an even more marvelous plane than that cargo plane. It's great technology. It was designed to defeat a Soviet fighter plane that was never built. It was designed with stealth covering to evade Soviet radar that was never built, okay? The Soviets disappointed our defense contractors by going out of business when they were most needed, all right? So, all right, we have the F-22. Again, as I said before, conservatively speaking, a $65 billion program. Okay, so I, in my book, attacked this thing, and I know, and there were people already said, what are you talking about? The F-22 is a marvelous plane. And it was pointed out when they fired, remember Gates just the other day, fired the top military person in the Air Force and the top civilian. And one charge, of course, is that they let that B-52 run around with nuclear weapons without anybody noticing across America. In other words, they sent this high-tech equipment to Taiwan for ballistic missiles. But one of the charges was these guys were pushing for hundreds more F-22s. And Gates pointed out the F-22 is yet to engage in a single combat mission in Afghanistan or Iraq. It's not needed. And you guys are pushing it. We don't want it. Okay, so finally, one of my arguments in the book about that weapon system has been resolved by our Secretary of Defense, and he'll probably be forced out, just like the admirals and generals who have objected to spending before. Yes.
But let's talk for a minute about your admiration for Senator McCain and his ability to ferret out a boondoggle of the Defense Department, legitimately, on their using Boeing 676s as tankers for gas stations in the sky, as they were described. Tell us a little bit about that scandal, which is a very much of a centerpiece of this book, to show how things go awry and the credit you give McCain for it.
Okay, well, let me just put matters to rest here. I am voting for Barack Obama. There's no, you know...
I didn't doubt that for a second.
So there's no issue here. I'm quite excited about the man and the freshness he brings and everything else. So, you know, not quite as excited as my wife, who's become a groupie and punches that $25 button, much to my chagrin. But, however, whatever I do as a citizen, I do have this occupation as a journalist. And I do feel as a journalist, you know, I don't want to use vulgar language here, but, you know, where I put it recently in an interview, I have to assume that I won't use the vulgar language. I have to assume that I'm full of it, okay? I have to assume that the person I'm interviewing, whether I'm interviewing you or anybody else, may have a handle on things that has eluded me up to now, and that I may have it all wrong and so forth. So when I was doing this book, I went to look at this weapon system. One of the reasons I looked at it is that Richard Perle was a big advocate of this.
And you'd interviewed him once.
And
with Scoop Jackson.
Yeah, I knew him for years. And but anyway, Boeing was in trouble. There wasn't much need for new commercial planes. They had an overstock. And some folks at Boeing and elsewhere hit on the idea, why doesn't the Air Force lease these planes, and we'll fill them up with fuel and use them for mid-flight refueling. We have already had planes that could do that, but it'll be a great way of helping Boeing. Okay. The only problem is that the conservative initial estimate of the program was $30 billion. And, when I throw these numbers around, remember, George Bush vetoed the extension of child health care insurance that would have covered 4 million children, because the price tag of $7 billion was too high. Okay? Boeing, this is a $30 billion boondoggle that everyone knew was quickly going to go to $100 billion. All right? Real money. Not as big as the, F-35, which multi-service, which is $300 billion. We got a lot of other things out there, but still not chump change, okay? 30 to $100 billion, somewhere in there. And so, Richard Perle wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal saying we must have this. Only the stupidest green eye shade accountant in the Defense Department would oppose this. It later turned out that Richard Perle had gotten $20 million from Boeing for his venture capital firm. Just a reminder that ideologues also have pocketbooks that they like to fill. What was interesting to me about it is that somebody, one of the Pentagon watchdogs that I like, a guy named Wheeler, was criticizing McCain for not being more vigilant, and he said, where is our Mr. Smith goes to Washington? Because there are two McCains, at least. And there is a McCain that can be quite appealing in a kind of libertarian way, not... John has. Let me give a plug for your book. There's a marvelous book that he. Did you edit it or compile it or the Goldwater book?
The Goldwater book.
Yeah.
It was based on journals by the senator. Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things you learn in there is that Goldwater, had his criticisms of McCain and so forth, which are quite interesting. So I'm not going to claim that McCain is as pure as Goldwater in this respect, but he certainly has had a desire to protect the taxpayer's dollar, at least since the savings and loan scandal. And, we had McCain-Feingold.
McCain had that?
No, I'm saying...
Facetiously, you're saying.
Yeah,
that.
I'm saying facetiously, John. But the point is, he suddenly got really excited about this waste stuff, and it wasn't the first time. And Warner supported him. Warner was.
Do you know why
he
got excited about it?
Are you going to explain that? Or?
Yeah, I am. But do you?
Let me just tell the story of what happened, and then we'll go to motive.
Okay.
Because what happened? And this you can't take away from. And not only can't you take it away from, but the Democrats have already started attacking him for doing something right. Right? McCain, because of McCain's getting his staff, really not the man, pursuing this boondoggle. You're going to probably tell me because he hates the Air Force and his father was an admiral and all that. But whatever his motivation, he got the emails. And as a result of his investigations, the CFO of Boeing went to federal prison and the top procurement officer in the Air Force went to federal prison, okay, because of McCain's diligence. And if you read nothing else in my book, there's a speech that I have there that the chief counsel of Boeing gave to assembled hotshots at Boeing, it will chill you, because he says, he discusses this scandal, and he says, you know, we have a big problem. We are perceived by the people we have to deal with in the government climates as crooks. And he says, now let's take one scandal. And this scandal, the chief procurement officer, who was also being courted by Lockheed, you know, the old revolving door, first thing she wanted was a job for a daughter. The next thing she wanted was a job for a son-in-law. The next thing she wanted was a job for herself as a major executive. And he said, and he goes through this whole thing. And what were we thinking? Have we never read about conflict of interest? The woman was still working there while we're negotiating with her. And is it any excuse that Lockheed was doing the same? You know, he lays this all out. What were we thinking? And then in each one of these vignettes, he says, but if that was all, maybe we could handle it. And then he goes through another scandal and another scandal. And he ends up, I think there were like 8 or 9 of these. And he said, no wonder we're held in such, you know, disrepute. And so what I'm saying is that none of that would have come out were it not for John McCain. As a journalist writing a book, I come across this thing. I did not know John McCain would be the candidate. You know, I did not know I would get everybody that I'm close to personally very angry with me because I have a positive word to say about John McCain. But it happens to be true.
Let me give
and
you
he, a... I will even go further since you've goaded me into this. I don't think there's anyone in the Senate, actually in the Senate certainly, who has been more vigilant in trying to control big ticket Pentagon spending than John McCain. So there, I've probably
earmarks.
Lost any sale I'll ever have, but there, it's in there. Yeah.
But no, I think your points are well taken. I think your description and your overview and explaining a very complex scandal is as eloquent and as succinct as I've ever seen. It's a scandal I happened to pay attention to some years ago. It just kind of fascinated me as former government guy, and I had when I read your book, I recalled how it had all started, and it started in late 2001 when John McCain purportedly said that he had seen a footnote in the federal budget. Now, I don't believe John McCain has ever read the federal budget in his entire term in office. Congressmen and senators do not sit around reading the federal budget. So my antenna went up immediately. I've been sitting on that for years. Recently, we now learn that John McCain has hired more lobbyists in his office, and he has run, in short, a school for lobbyists who've gone through the revolving door back to the private sector.
Good-looking lobbyists, too, actually.
Some attractive, some not so attractive. But anyway, when I dug around after I read your section to see, did any of his lobbyists represent Martin Marietta, which was the competitor that was going to hurt the most if this tanker deal went forward? And sure enough, no less than the co-chairman of his campaign is a lobbyist who represents Martin Marietta. And they have a long-time relationship. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that McCain was tipped off to this. He wasn't sifting through the budget to find this footnote and suddenly say, this is a good idea. He was told by one of his lobbyist friends, here's an issue you can run with, John, and help us.
Well,
that's my perception of what happened
right. And
where it started. Not that he didn't do a good thing, but I just wanted to add a little footnote to your analysis of it.
In response to that, I would only say it's a pity that Barbara Boxer and Senator Feingold and others have not been tipped off by lobbyists to expose other systems. Because what he did...
Amen.
What he did, whatever the motivation, and you know, he's going to be attacked now because Airbus ended up getting the contract, and people are going to accuse him of costing jobs in specific districts and states. That's how this game is played, and you know, particularly to a foreign company. And there has already been some attacks on him for this. But what it took, and this is maybe the negative side of McCain as well as the positive, he may not sit around and read reports, but he's not a person you want to cross. And what happened was when the Air Force...
I believe he's been called Mr. McNasty.
Yeah. And so what happened, and I do discuss that in the book.
And I hold nothing against the man, I understand.
Yeah, when the Air Force, I think he, by the way, one of the points I would say, and I'm not being cute here, I think McCain is a useful senator. I think he'd be a little bit scary as president. But I think those qualities that people call attention to are good in a senator. You're supposed to be, you know, a little bit nasty about these things, and he doesn't suffer the fools in the bureaucracy. And when they went after them, instead of collapsing, he fought back. He demanded the emails, he demanded his staff, and what offended him, the reason this thing with the federal budget matters, is this thing did not go before committee hearings. It was not discussed, it was not debated, okay? It was slipped in. $30 billion to soon to be $100 billion slipped in without any staff work, without any examination. And it wasn't just McCain who was offended by that. It was Warner who was actually head of the committee. Where did this thing come from?
Well, Warner was offended when Boeing supplied him redacted slides, if you recall.
Yeah.
That's what got him annoyed. And that's when he joined McCain and said, hey, let's go after these people.
You know, I said, this is the smartest guy in America. He reads three books a day. No, this is really true. I'm not being cute here. We have these kind of discussions all the time. All the time. And you've just confirmed my my praise.
It's that clumsy memory of mine.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's a last subject in the few minutes we have left that I think would be interesting to turn to is Dick Cheney and his role in all this. You note that when Cheney was Secretary of Defense, that indeed he joined with George Bush to start cutting back in the post-Cold War era the budget. As I pointed out in our conversation, you know, I think that Cheney was merely following the boss's order, since he was working on internal documents to try to increase the spending, and this has been something that he has carried with him, both in the private sector, now that he's returned to government. He's had 8 years to have a free rein at a president who doesn't care much about these issues to pump up spending, this making your book very timely and important. I'd like your feeling about what the next president might do to bring and peel back this, starting with maybe a vice president who wasn't in charge of military industrial spending.
Yeah, I think the problem with Cheney, whatever, you know, as you know, the Republican Party, obviously much better than I do, but it seems to me it's a weird coalition between ultra-greedy, short-term capitalists and religious nuts, which I can't quite fathom all the time. But there's another tension.
It's falling apart, I can tell you.
But there's another tension between sort of genuine libertarian small government, you know, Goldwater, whom you celebrate, and increasingly that's in a position that appeals to me. This will alienate my last friend here. But frankly, after
wait a minute, Goldwater is today left of center.
I understand that, you know, particularly on some of these divisive social issues like gay rights. But I mean that in a serious way, because I did 9 radio shows yesterday. And I couldn't tell whether I'm being interviewed from the left or from the far right. You know, there was sort of, and it hit me. So some guy, some right wing guy, said, "Well, you know, you're attacking the military and everything on waste, but what about the rest of the waste in federal government?" I said, "Well, first of all, you know, you don't have me there. I'll make a deal with you. I'd be willing to get rid of the federal government. Most of what the federal government does involves expenditure of money that I don't support." Particularly when you come to discretionary funds, not the mandates. We're not going to touch the mandates. We're not going to touch Social Security. We're not going to touch Medicare. These are two, probably the two most successful programs in the history of this country. It's why old people are not. I spoke at Leisure World 2 nights ago. I could tell you, you dare lift a finger against those two programs, those people are going to have muskets and shoot your ass off, you know. That's not going to happen. And these entitlements really are for programs that work and are great and so forth. And I say this, by the way, as someone who is exactly John McCain's age. And I'm, as with John McCain, we're both paying in for Social Security and we're paying taxes on the Social Security we might elect to collect. So we're productive citizens. I will say one note on that, that I do think at 72, we may not have the attention span that is required to be president. I don't think it's ageist to say that, but I misplaced my keys 3 times today. And I just wonder, when you get that call at 3 o'clock in the morning, will you remember who called, let alone... But throwing out that, okay, so you're not going to touch Medicare and Social Security, you're not going to raise taxes. I don't care if Democrat or Republican. So you're talking about fighting what are called discretionary funds. Upwards, close to 60% of discretionary funds now go to the military. So you're going to be fighting about the 40% that's left. And whether you're Obama or whether you're McCain, these programs, whether it's subprime mortgage, whether it's helping New Orleans, whether it's improving education so we can train people, can compete with India and China, whatever it is, you're not going to have the funds. You're not going to be able to do it. And the idea that this election is being pursued without that being discussed, in fact, both of our surviving candidates now want to increase the size of the military. Both are on record as saying we need to beef up the military. All right? That, to my mind, is appalling. First of all, it indicates our democracy doesn't work very well. Where is this fear? Why is this a third rail issue? Why can we not discuss the rational allocation of our resources when it comes to defense spending, when it comes to national security? Why do we become idiots? Why do we avoid the elephant in the room, which is this defense spending? And if you look at, we went through all of these debates, and with the exception of Ron Paul on the libertarian side or Dennis Kucinich or so forth, you know, people who are totally marginalized, the others, maybe Richardson with some exception, a few others, didn't discuss this thing. And if you don't discuss it, you really can't talk about not only the rational allocation of resources, let me just add a little bit here, you can't talk about the real menace of the spending. And let me just say something about this. Because you'll hear people say, oh, what, you know, it's only 4% of this and blah, 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 you know. Okay, first of all, as I said before, when you talk about discretionary spending, it's a big chunk, all right, of what we're actually going to spend. It's real money. A trillion here, a trillion there, you're talking real money, all right? And don't let them tell you differently. And that's a large part of the debt that we have, all right? But you don't build weapons without finding an excuse to use them. The threat inflation that Eisenhower warned about, okay, finding enemies, using the military option before you use other options, stressing the military is because you want to use these toys so that they become meaningful, you know, for your ego, for your sense of yourself, but to justify them to the taxpayer. And so when you have a military economy, you will have wars. All right? And the shame of this here is, and let me throw in one, can I throw in one other big idea?
You may indeed, please. Indeed,
thank you. I want to throw in one big idea. Another hero in my book, I don't deal with him extensively, is George Washington, somebody I've adopted later in life. And George Washington uttered a sentence that I think should be on buildings. And unfortunately, I cannot remember the sentence. I asked John, hey, can I tell you the truth, but I will ask my wife or Josh over there. I recall it's, he warned us about the impostures of, and that it's not false, what is it? Pretended patriotism. Impostures of pretended patriotism. When is the last time a major politician in this country has warned us about the impostures of false patriotism? And that is what we needed to be warned about in this post 9/11 period. We were dealing with a pathology. We were dealing with an illness that had to be treated surgically. You don't have to obliterate the landscape. You don't have to seize whole countries. You have to learn some languages. And instead of dealing with it in a clinical, serious way, we surrendered to this false patriotism and said, our way or the highway, you're either with us or you're against America. Love the troops. Build the planes we don't need. Build the ships we don't need. And we don't have a politician today who will speak truth to this. And I'm going to get, can I get to the pro-Goldwater thing? And why I say, and then I'll end on this.
Okay.
Okay. No, but I'm serious about this, and I would really recommend reading the book that John worked on, because these are Goldwater's own words. I think what Washington was talking about, what the founders were talking about, is that you cannot have popular control and a republic and have an empire. They are contradictions in terms. Because what we mean by a republic, a popular republic, is an informed citizenry. And I know this from writing local columns. When I wrote my local columns for the west side of LA, and I said, you need a traffic light there, or the school is not working, or the pedestrian safety is not being taken care of, people could say, sure, you're full of it, or you're right, or I'll look at it, I'll go check myself, I'll see, you know? And they were not denied any key information. We have sunshine laws. They could see what the city council did, and so forth. When you move to the other extreme of these international relations and the enemy at the gate, you know, national security, classification, the discussion is meaningless. You know, we bomb North Vietnam Fulbright said it was the worst thing he ever did, carrying that resolution, on the basis that we were attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin, and we learned 20 years later that McNamara and Johnson knew in real time there was no evidence to support the attack that never happened, okay? With Iraq, we learned about the lies a bit sooner. But the fact of the matter is you cannot have an informed citizenry if you're conquering the world, and the military is the main emphasis, and foreign adventure is the key. You can't have it. And so when I say I would give up the big federal government, or at least cut it back, and return power to the states, return power to our domestic life, and it's not a position that says we don't care about the world. Obviously, Jefferson and Washington and Eisenhower cared a great deal about the rest of the world, but you can engage in with the rest of the world without the military being the primary focus, and that's what has characterized this administration.
Robert, I think those 4 points you made are excellent points to conclude this phase and open it up to questions from the audience. I like your points, all of them. The candidates noting that they're all calling for more spending. The bogus patriotism we all know is haunting the land, and indeed the need for control over military spending by informed citizens is vital, and that's why you don't see many books written in as fluent and a flowing and easily read form as this, very palatable notwithstanding a horrible title, on a very vital subject. So with that, let's open it up for questions. We'll start down here and we'll move around the room. There's a mic that will come down, and then we'll see where this goes.
I'd like your comment on George W. Bush calls George H.W. Bush Poppy. In 1993, Poppy went to Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein tried to have him assassinated. In the early 1700s, the Spanish captured a British sailor called Jenkins and cut off his ear. And the British went to war, the War of Jenkins' Ear. I believe that what we have, truthfully and psychologically, is the war of Poppy's boy.
Well, no, I disagree with that. I think that if that were true, George W. would have been more interested in foreign adventure when he was running for office, and he would have been in the first year, and he wasn't. And that was not the tone of the administration. I think 9/11 became a gift to this administration because they were floundering. First of all, he had, you know, there was a question about whether he'd been properly elected. He clearly was in over his head. It was not going well. The popularity was down. And 9/11 gave him his chance to shine. I do think one could say, yes, he wanted the second term, and he wanted to exceed his father. I'm not going to deny those things. But I think really what happened was that other people floated his boat. And that's where the lobbyists, that's where the foreign policy neoconservatives come in.
And Dick Cheney.
Yes, and no question, by the way.
I think Dick Cheney's true genius is that he lets George Bush wake up every morning and actually think he is president.
Yeah.
Let's have another question. Gentleman up here had one. I saw one. Yes. Yes, right here with a striped shirt.
Well, we have two distinguished people here. McCain got involved with the business with the Marianas and all the people there that were really doing horrible things. And as soon as he found out that the Republicans, big Republicans, were in charge, he dropped it. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, let me drop McCain here. McCain only enters my book, okay, and as John said, this book, it contains a number of case studies of how it works. And McCain is only in basically one chapter in my book, And he's in there because he played this pivotal role in exposing what Warner called the most egregious waste of taxpayer dollars he had seen.
He dug and dug and dug and dug and used his power to find out what Boeing was doing, what the feds were doing, and did it against not only Boeing's resistance, but George Bush's resistance and Rumsfeld's resistance. And I think that's a point well made in the book.
Let me tell you a little story, by the way. I got into just this kind of trouble last night. You know, talking about my book at my good friend Stanley and Betty Scheinbaum's house and good West Side liberal people, and I again opened my stupid mouth about McCain. And it was talking. Then after the thing, two school teacher friends of mine from Orange County came up to me, a guy named Bruce Barron, who is a principal of a elementary school, and he said, you know, interesting you said that, because I was just at a party for one of our teachers, and her husband works at Boeing. And her husband said, you know, we're very excited about this election and everything. And he said, I assumed that many was for McCain. And so I asked him, I said, so you're for McCain? He says, oh, no, we hate McCain. Everyone at Boeing hates McCain. We are Obama people.
Well,
okay?
Obama,
now, I'm not doing this to smear Obama.
Why do you think Boeing moved to Chicago?
Yeah. Cheap
Let's
shot.
Let's have another question. Yes, right here on the aisle.
Hi. Bob, I don't mean to try to force you to defend your pal McCain again, but you were you started a little story about Wheeler and Mr. Smith, and you sort of wandered off and didn't complete it, and I was getting excited when you brought it up because I thought that he was someone who, I believe McCain got him fired in a really kind of horrible way. So I didn't know where you were going with that, and I thought you might be going there with it.
Well, okay. All I was trying to say there is that Wheeler had
said... Not everybody knows who Wheeler is.
Well, he's one of the great whistleblowers and critics and so forth. And we have a number of them. Lawrence Korb is another. I mean, there's nothing in my book that hasn't been said by a bunch of very good people at the Center for Defense Information, at other places. You know, we have admirals who've spoken out and generals and so forth. So it's not as if this is some great investigative journalism. The problem is no one pays attention to these people, and Wheeler is one of them. And his Mr. Smith thing, at first I think it was just a self-published little thing. I know it cost me about $70 to get it. It was a very good statement. And yes, he was making a very good criticism of McCain, that this guy comes on as the Mr. Smith goes to Washington as this great independent figure, and it is a spotty record. And he said in this case at that point, the weapon system, he said the guy is not taking him on. Well, then McCain, maybe in response to that, whatever, maybe for the reasons you mentioned, did play a key role. My book is not primarily about McCain. It is a part of one chapter.
I don't know why this
has become the whole subject here.
One of the nice things you say about McCain, that it
you haven't even brought up Nixon yet. You know, the book begins with my tribute to Nixon.
I understand that. We can look through that. But what people don't understand about McCain, and this lays out, particularly when you understand the number of lobbyists that this man operates with, that he's a good, in saying this not in a pejorative way, but he's a good opportunist. He knows how to find an opportunity and dig in and go after it. That runs from everything from uncovering Boeing's bribing procurement officers to capturing the presidential nomination in 2008. He knows when to move.
Okay, but can I just say one thing about this? And this is my last McCain thing. If McCain is so just another opportunist, why haven't other senators done this? Now, Bernie Sanders has. I mean, there are a few people, you know. There are a few members of the House, you know. Not Murtha, for instance, who people like. He supported the subs. Why? Because a Democratic congressman.
Give you a list tomorrow.
Okay. There are very few people. Henry Waxman certainly is a huge hero on defense spending. Absolutely. There are others. But on the Senate side, I would have to say, and that this is not so much a tribute to McCain as it is a condemnation of the other senators.
Remember,
they are not looking into this stuff.
The Congress was under, for the last umpteen years now, until 06, under Republican control. They're not about all the, you know, yes, they were very vigilant in finding out what Bill Clinton was doing in the late of the night in his in the Oval Office. In fact, one of his one of those calls with Sonny Montgomery relates to defense spending when he's with Monica. But that's another subject. But anyway,
let me push this a little further. Okay,
we need to get another question in. Let's get a couple more questions in. Lady, right up here. Yes, she's going to tap you.
A couple of Mondays ago, there was a little tiny article on like page 12 of the LA Times, and it said that like half of the kajillion dollars of military spending is untraceable. And so I went right over and I wrote to the LA Times and I said, don't you think that would be like a first page article? I was just wanting to get your opinion about newspapers and their coverage of this particular war.
Well, that was the point Rumsfeld was making in his speech the day before 9/11, and I have it. I have a whole chapter on this, much more interesting chapter, by the way, than the McCain thing that is getting me in so much trouble. Worth the price of the book just on its own. But that was what Rumsfeld said. He used the figure $2 trillion. He said, we have in this building $2 trillion worth of expenditures that we cannot trace. We don't know where they went. We don't know what they're for. That's Rumsfeld saying it. This was after having had the job for a while. He said, and that, you know, that's only the stuff we know just has disappeared. That has nothing to do with the junk that's being built that we don't need, you know. And it was a very clear statement. Now, you're raising another question. Why doesn't the media cover it? And I don't know. Is it boring? Is it, you know, complex? Is there a conflict of interest? The answer that I've gotten, because my publisher, which is a rather big publisher this time, Hachette, which has 12 and has a lot of bestsellers, and they've been trying to get me reviewed, and I've had some good reviews in Publishers Weekly and the New York Observer and so forth, but I'm not going to be reviewed by the New York Times or the Washington Post. Maybe one reason for the New York Times is I have a whole chapter analyzing Thomas Friedman, who is a person who has distinguished himself by getting most things wrong for the last 8 years. You know, there isn't really much interest in this stuff. Is it because, and I would say the main reason, not just the advertising and the jobs and all the other things which influence media, and not also cross-ownership in the case of NBC and GE and so forth, but the other thing is, what happened after 9/11, and that's why I talk about the hijacking of 9/11, the hysteria, the media got chicken. The mainstream print media, which is losing market share, is worried about not getting readers back, panicked. It was the most disgraceful period, you know, since the main, you know, for the mass media. They just simply forgot their role, and they rolled over. And even now, what I've been told by my publisher, when they say, you don't get on this show and you don't get that, people even now do not want to take on defense spending. As I was told, someone from Newsweek, very prominent, said to my publisher at a party, said, look, we're involved in two wars, we're facing terrorism, and you think we're going to highlight somebody who said we should be spending less rather than more money on supporting the troops? Well, the point of my book is this has nothing to do with supporting the troops.
Last question. Over here, another lady over here. And while you're getting over
why
there,
why don't we just do this for another hour?
What's because we were told the hook came out at 8:15.
Oh, okay.
But let me, I was going to say something, but now the question's ready.
You've both mentioned Cheney during the course of the evening. I'd like to hear from both of you on what you think motivates Mr. Cheney, because I've never been able to figure out what motivates this man.
I wrote a book on it called Conservatives Without Conscience. You might get the gist of it right there. He's an authoritarian personality and is acting in exactly the way authoritarian personalities act. He was savvy when he took the job. He obviously negotiated with Bush before accepting the post. The model for the strong vice presidency is not Dick Cheney. He actually looked back to Walter Mondale, who under Carter showed how the vice presidency can be very important, with Mondale really helping Carter, who was very unfamiliar with Washington, learn how to run the government, and doing so keeping totally out of the limelight and behind the staff, behind the headlines. Mondale rose to be really the key aide for Carter in the White House. Cheney saw, Newt was aware of that model and took it one step farther. it, you know, I didn't know Cheney when I was in the Nixon White House, and what I knew about him, however, is not terribly surprising. He has really not changed his views an iota since he was Ford's White House Chief of Staff. Before that, before he was an aide to Don Rumsfeld, he has been totally consistent. And now he's found a precedent through which he can implement the beliefs he has held so strongly in this authoritarian personality that he is. But let me close, since we got on. There can also be an opportunity to ask questions when we're signing books. I hope you all will realize that Bob has given you a book where you can understand a very complex, often unrecognized subject, the spending and the military complex that's out of hand, how it gets out of hand, and what some of the consequences of it are in a rather easy, digestible form. Great Father's Day gift as well, if you need two or three copies. But let me just close, since we did end up on McCain so much. I've been thinking a lot about his short list of who he might add as his VP. And I just want to give you these parting shots. There's been a lot of talk about Romney, Mitt Romney being his one of his high choices. And people have been asking me ever since Romney surfaced as a viable candidate for something, people said, is this man Nixonian at all? And I have said, absolutely. This is Richard Nixon on Prozac. More troubling, and another one that keeps popping up on the list, is Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani is Richard Nixon on crystal meth. So I'll let you leave with that. Let's go sign some books.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.